upward price pressure on silver is so dramatic that nobody needs to tell you the silver's broken out. There are people now who will argue that a breakout in the silver price above 31 or 32 to 35 is something special. Judging from past silver bull markets, that's a rounding error. I mean, truly a rounding error. So I'm not convinced that the silver bullion is in a breakout phase, or that leadership in the precious metals bull markets is going to shift from gold to silver. I remember in our earlier interview describing the high-quality junior stocks as a coiled spring. That wasn't so much about the fact that I thought the silver price was going to break out. It was about the fact that the silver equities were hated.
Rick, how are you? Good to see you.
I'm doing very well, thank you. The better for visiting with you and your audience through you as a medium. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And the last video we did that was shot was did very well. What I'll do here, let's talk about what's happening right now. Well, I take that back. It has been happening for a while, but it's gaining some momentum, is this silver breakout. When you and I first started talking, it was about a year ago, you mentioned to me that gold's going to move first, then silver will catch up. And then when silver goes, it really goes. And the words you used, the silver stocks in the past went goofy. So give the heat for 30,000 foot view on this start of this move, if you would.
Well, I'm not convinced that we're in a silver bullion breakout yet. I think silver has merely caught a bid. If you look at gold, gold is approaching its real as opposed to nominal all-time highs at $2,700. Silver's nominal high was $50, but the inflation-adjusted number is more like 80. So silver, I think, has a while to rip. In my own experience, as we talked about earlier, precious metals bull markets are inevitably led by gold, because the first buyer is a fear buyer. When the precious metals narrative gets established by gold and the momentum comes into gold, the next step is the generalist investor coming down into the precious metals space. And the generalist investor, whose motivations are both fear and greed, tends to favor silver because of its volatility and perhaps because of its lower unit price over gold. And then leadership changes to silver. And in my experience, when that happens, you don't have to look for some subtle signs. The upward price pressure on silver is so dramatic that nobody needs to tell you the silver's broken out. There are people now who will argue that a breakout in the silver price above 31 or 32 to 35 is something special. Judging from past silver bull markets, that's a rounding error. I mean, truly a rounding error. So I'm not convinced that the silver bullion is in a breakout phase, or that leadership in the precious metals bull markets is going to shift from gold to silver. I remember in our earlier interview describing the high-quality junior stocks as a coiled spring. That wasn't so much about the fact that I thought the silver price was going to break out. It was about the fact that the silver equities were hated. They were hated, I think, because a whole generation of speculators was spawned in 2010, 2011 with the Reddit silver squeeze. They had expected immediate gratification. And when they didn't get it, let's just say that there's no hate as sincere as the hate of a jilted lover. And the junior silver stocks probably ran into 150,000 jilted lovers. Really, truly profound hate. And it seemed to me at that point in time that with or without the silver moving, that there was nobody left to sell. Everybody who wanted to sell, November, December, January, had sold. And that turned out to be, miraculously, even in terms of timing, exactly right. The higher quality junior silver stocks, I think we're going to talk about a couple of them today, are uniformly up 200% this year without the silver price moving that much. They're up on what I would describe as a dead cat bounce. They're also up on results, which is very, very, very healthy. It is arguable that those stocks don't need to go up anymore at these silver prices. But if past is prologue and we have a silver bull market coming up, which is to say that the primary metal itself does what it has done, I think people will be surprised at the performance, the ultimate performance of silver equities. Notice that I preceded all of that with the word if. Speculators are looking for certainty, which I think is too much to ask for in any speculative market. You assign probabilities to outcome and you risk those probabilities. And that's maybe what we'll talk about today.
Yeah, let's talk about probabilities, and let's talk about probabilities with stocks. And if I can do two things. First, to the end general audience, we're going to talk about, or I'd like to ask you about, two different companies. What has happened in the past, this gets filled up with everybody wanting to know about stocks they own or their favorite mining stock. Are you still offering an analysis on portfolios?
Absolutely. All your listeners have to do is go to my website, ruleinvestmentmedia.com, and list their natural resource stocks. I will, for no fee and no obligation, rank them 1 to 10. 1 being best, by the way, that's a very rare ranking, and 10 being worst. I will also comment about individual issues if I think my comments might have value. Note, first of all, that my rankings are extremely harsh, rougher than any newsletter writer I know, and substantially rougher than most investment banks who get commissions for recommending stocks. Notice, too, that I'm just back from a 3-week vacation, so I'm way behind. And if you submit your portfolio for rankings, don't feel bad if you don't get your rankings back for 10 days. I had 60 or 70 arrive overnight, and I was already 400 or 450 behind. The weekend is coming up, so I should be able to get caught up. But don't feel bad if you don't hear from me for 10 days.
So here we go. And also to all the listeners and viewers, if you do want to put your stock in there, please put your stock in there. It just helps with the algorithm, to be candid. But let's talk about a few different silver stocks, if you would. So over the weekend, I had dinner with the CEO of Abra Silver, John Miniotis. For all those listening, John has no idea that I'm asking Rick about his company. Rick, what are your thoughts about John? And I'll tell you mine, but I'd love to know what your thoughts are about Abra Silver and really about the CEO. To be candid, I think he's fantastic, but tell me about the stock.
Well, I should precede this by saying I'm long Abra Silver. So people need to know when they hear my remarks that I'm long. I'm not merely up, I'm way up. Note too that I have known the geologist there, VP Exploration, for 30 years. He used to work for Ross Beaty. I have a high degree of confidence in him. And I like John Miniotis. I like the fact that when I ask him to describe for me three things that can go wrong, he has three things that can go wrong right on the top of his head. He doesn't BS anybody, including himself. And that's important because if you have identified at least three risks and you have contingency plans in place to deal with the risks, then you're a good CEO. You're not a used car salesman. I also like the fact that he understands capital markets. A lot of CEOs with an exploration project like this would raise money when they needed it. They play just-in-time chicken with capital markets. Miniotis raises the money when market conditions are good, as opposed to waiting until he needs the money. He has been criticized by some people for tapping equity markets too much. The fact that his stock is up 250% will tell you something about the fact that his strategic timing for raising capital, which allows them to run 8 or 10 rigs, is much more intelligent then this is just in time BS that some people do to manipulate markets. So he's a high quality guy. I also need to say, well, two things. The project Diablillos is one that I helped Silver Standard buy many years ago. And I'm embarrassed to say that the exploration potential was completely lost on us. So I'm delighted that this team has taken a project and has done it justice. What is important to me with Abra Silver right now is it would seem that they understand the nature of the deposit or deposits so well. The drilling has become predictive. In other words, they say, this is what we think is happening. We're going to test this idea with 8 or 10 drill holes. And the 8 or 10 drill holes confirm the idea. In my experience, often but not always, when the deposits are well enough understood that the drilling becomes predictive, you're at sort of a fulcrum point in terms of net present value additions. And I think we may be there with Abra. I think they understand the deposit. I think the nature of mineralization is profound. But importantly, it looks to me like the drilling is becoming predictive. When drilling becomes predictive, the amount of ounces that you add can, I'm not saying they will, but can go up dramatically. Note finally that the Abra deposit is in a fairly remote part of Salta province, so that the front-end capital costs are going to be pretty high, but they're coming down as a consequence of other precious metal developments, and particularly lithium developments on the Salta Plateau. So when you look at the fact that this is, by nature, vicuña pasture, high, dry, and remote, understand that there are other active mining operations within 40 kilometers, which is to say 25 miles of this deposit. Unlike when we had it in Silver Standard, and you had to get there by horseback or by helicopter, two unpleasant options, you can drive there now, which makes a big, big, big difference. So I hope that helps.
That does. If you could, and I asked John this, what can go wrong, really? Because I'm just analyzing the corporate presentation. Again, that's a corporate presentation. It was very impressive, but that's what they're meant to be, right? I'm trying to figure out the whole. And as a caveat, I do not own this stock, and it's been one of the biggest regrets I've had probably the last several years. Go ahead.
Well, a lot of things can go wrong. Their understanding of the deposit and my understanding of their understanding could be wrong. Given where this deposit is, pardon me, the front-end capital costs are going to be large. Mm-hmm. And that means that the deposit has to have really superb gross economics to overcome the infrastructure part of the front-end capital costs. In other words, a deposit of tonnage and grade which would work on a paved highway in central Mexico, aren't going to work here. You know, you are a long way from anywhere. You are high and dry. So the fact that it's an excellent deposit helps, but it's going to have to be a real excellent deposit. The second thing is that in some parts of Salta, there is a developing anti-mining sentiment at the local level. I last year drove from the capital, Salta, down 3 hours to Cafayate, which in the Cauchique Valley is the access to the Altiplano where the mineral developments are. And there were lots of popular roadside signs that were anti-mining and anti-development. It would appear that the national politics in Argentina are getting dramatically better. But one always needs to pay attention to local politics in Argentina. And the tendency of local caciques, big men, to mobilize populist support for political currency. And so that's something that you need to worry about. And I would suspect, from my viewpoint, those are the two critical elements. Of course, you're going to have speculators in the stock who don't understand the time it's going to take to finish drilling this deposit off, that don't understand the progression in value from resource statement to preliminary economic assessment to pre-feasibility study, to bankable feasibility study, don't have any patience with the permitting process, and don't understand the amount of capital that's going to be required on the front end, both to fund remote mine construction, but also to fund power, camp, access, egress, wastewater management. This is going to be a very complex process. If it works, I think it's going to work, and I think it is going to work, by the way. I think it's going to work in spades. But notice that it isn't going to work on many speculators' timeframes.
Right.
In my experience, we've talked about this before, Andy, the anatomy of a 10-bagger, what's required to get 1,000% in a stock, is, among other things, 5 years or 6 years. Many people that invest in resources have a long-term thesis, a long-term strategy, but they employ short-term tactics. And that's not going to work here. If you're hoping for a three-month hit, I don't know, go to Las Vegas or, you know, do something fun with your money.
Okay, excellent. So another stock that I'd like to talk to you about, and full disclosure on this, my family does own it. My daughter has owned it for a while now, and she has tripled her money. And I don't own it. I wish I did. I more than likely will own this as well. It's Dolly Varden. I met with the CEO, Sean Kuhn. This was at another conference just a little time ago. I must say, he caught me by surprise two things, but he's young, and that's a big positive, I think, because he has so much energy and intensity about him. It depends, though. I do think he needs a good team around him of experience, but I just loved his energy. And we were putting each other on the hot seat, going back and forth, and he just really came out in spades. I want to say that about him, but I would like to know your opinion of Dolly Varden.
Well, I need to say that I also own Dolly Varden. I need to say further, the stock has performed very well. It's performed so well that I sold enough that I have my initial capital back. I'm at what I laughingly call the point of no concern, where the stock that I have remaining is, in casino parlance, on the house's money. And I'm very happy about that. I share your high regard for Sean. He's a very, very bright guy. Mm-hmm. He is conversant and thoughtful on a lot of subjects, not just mining, which says something, I say, overall about both his curiosity and his intellect. As you suggest, he's young and has energy. If I had a caution around Sean, it's that he's doing too many things at once. He's involved in too many companies. He's involved with the Discovery Group, which is a very high-quality Vancouver group that's been responsible for global exploration, global development for a long time. Indirectly, the group itself is backed by Frank Giustra, a long-time Vancouver mine financier and friend of mine for four decades.
So I like all that.
The story around Dolly Varden is a lot simpler. They have a high-grade deposit, which has been known about for a very long time. It was in production in the 70s. It languished for a very long time because it was used for various stock promotions. There were some really good, high-quality hits. A new promoter would get it. They'd twin the old hit, get some big numbers, run the stock up, do a financing, live off the financing, and they never expanded the original deposit. When Sean got it, he got serious. As opposed merely to using the drill bit to ramp the stock, he used the drill bit to expand the deposit. Lo and behold, he did. The second thing he did was he went to Ivan Bebek and he bought a deposit called Homestake Ridge above the old Dolly Varden deposit, theorizing that those two deposits in relatively close proximity to each other had a similar genesis. And if they weren't connected, that at least perhaps they represented a camp as opposed to two distinct deposits. And Sean has done three things really. He has continued to drill out the Dolly Varden, the so-called Valley Discovery, while he has continued to drill out Homestake Ridge. But importantly, they've begun to do important work between the two deposits. to look at the geology and look at the nature of mineralization, and to the extent that they can, tie the two deposits together. If the two deposits do tie together, both exhibit some polyphase mineralization, which is good. If the two deposits do tie together, and I'm not saying any that they do, by the way, I use the word if. If those two are related, that has profound implications for size. And I think we're going to find that out in the next 18 months. If they don't tie together, but if there is sufficient mineralization at the ridge and in the valley, and if that mineralization is consistent enough that one processing facility can be utilized for both deposits, that's probably a home run. But if the deposits do tie together in some way, shape, or form, then the tonnage implications are such that it's a long ball home run. What could go wrong? Pretty easy. I could be wrong. If they don't develop enough ore at one or the other deposits, this becomes a science project. That's the nature of exploration. You're answering a series of unanswered questions. Mercifully, with this one, there's three potential unanswered questions, and they all have relatively rewarding circumstances if the answers are yes. Thus far, the answers are yes to the Valley Zone, yes to Homestake Ridge, and maybe to the combination of the two.
Got it. Okay, to all the listeners and viewers out there, there's a couple of silver stocks to consider, not an endorsement. Rick's involved in both. I'm involved, or my family's involved in one. I am looking to be involved in both. That is full disclosure. Rick, let's talk about hated assets, one of your favorite topics, and actually one of mine. I would like actually to start with, you said something interesting to me, that you are developing a ranking with lithium companies. Correct me if I'm wrong, please. Talk a little bit about lithium. I know we've had quite a good spike here recently. And let's also talk about other critical metals, maybe like nickel I'm thinking of, and perhaps copper. Where are we at with those assets?
Lithium is a fascinating topic. Thus, the cyclicality in resources and the cyclicality in investor sentiment, which is usually back-asswards. I was brought up in the oil and gas business, and I was active in the geothermal business. And in both of those businesses, lithium is a waste product. It's brine. It's scale. It fouls your equipment. But I understood that there were lots of industrial applications for lithium, not all of which were mood-altering. And with the advent of the lithium-ion battery, demand for lithium rose faster than the industry's ability to supply it. There was never, Andy, a shortage of elemental lithium. At the height of the lithium boom, the shortage, by the way, came in processing capacity. We had plenty of brine lithium. We had plenty of rock lithium. We couldn't produce the volumes that were necessary, but the real critical shortage was in processing capacity. Turning elemental lithium into lithium chemicals that were suitable for industrial applications like lithium-ion batteries. The price of processed lithium went up, if my memory serves me correct, sixfold or sevenfold. Pretty interesting jump. Even at the peak of the mania, the second biggest lithium producer in the world, SQM, the big Chilean brine producer, said that at current production rates, they had 85 years of reserves. So we didn't have a shortage of elemental lithium. But with the price spike, the exploration industry will raise money and explore for anything that the market will pay them for.
Right.
And the market for lithium was extraordinarily strong at a period in time when the market for things like copper and gold were very weak. So everybody and their brother switched from other kinds of exploration to lithium exploration. The industry raised billions of dollars, and a whole new generation of mining speculators was born. What I call the young green crew. And there were hundreds of thousands of them that were attracted to the technological parts of lithium and laterally the whole suite of battery metals. At any rate, billions of dollars were spent and probably 150 deposits were discovered. Meanwhile, the existing lithium producers were ramping up their production of lithium, and more importantly, debottlenecking their processing capacity. And all of a sudden, supply met demand, which meant that the price of lithium fell by 75%.
Yes.
So we're in a place now where there's this tremendous hangover. There are probably 150 lithium deposits, and the world probably needs 6 or 7 or maybe 10. So the job is going to be twofold. It's going to be searching through the 150 to try to find the 10 best, and then waiting till the point in time when the mood of the lithium speculators turns from disappointment to hatred. When the social media comments around lithium resemble the social media comments around uranium in 2021, which is to say, it's a scam, it's dead, it's never coming back. The pundits were all shysters. When lithium becomes parenthetically a four-letter word, you know, people bought the lithium stocks with no regard for their quality. In movie parlance, the good, the bad, and the ugly all went up. And in my experience, when hate replaces hope, the same thing happens on the sell side. The good deposits will be sold off with the bad deposits. Make no mistake, we aren't there yet.
Right.
The recent move by Rio to buy a lithium junior at a 90% premium has given real hope to the sector. Enough hope that, as an example, a very recent Marin Katusa promotion around Lyft has taken the price of Lyft up by 200% on massive buying. There is still a lot of currency in the lithium narrative. And given that, I have no interest in buying lithium stocks today. I want to see hope return. I want to see a direct mail promotion or an email promotion around lithium fall flat, absolutely flat. And I want to see real disgust in the social media comments around lithium. I suspect that'll happen 1.5 years out. When that happens, the very low price of lithium will again stimulate demand. And you will see, as you're beginning to see now, a reduction in productive capacity, which is always a bullish sign. Reduced supply is always a bullish sign. And I suspect that I'll get the same kind of move in my junior lithium stocks that I got in my junior uranium stocks, which is to say mind-boggling. I think, too, that the lithium market has the potential to become a contract or term market rather than a spot market, just as uranium has.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't happened yet, but I suspect that you will see strategic tie-ups between lithium product consumers and lithium producers. That'll be important because you then free the lithium producers from the tyranny of overnight market spot markets. And you allow some certainty as to volumes and price over time. This hasn't happened yet. This is right now a figment of Rick Rule's fertile imagination. I see the Chinese beginning to move in precisely that direction. And if they do move in that direction, the West is going to have to compete to keep up. So I think 1.5 years from now, it's not unlikely that if you and I are interviewing, we will challenge your listeners who have been predisposed to hate lithium as a consequence of social media discussion and try to present opportunities to them in the same way that we would have with uranium in 2021.
So that is a very interesting thesis that it would go to a contract market, as you've said. I guess we'll see, but that's very interesting. I would like to revisit that sometime.
I look forward to it. My former colleagues at Sprott Capital Partners, now SCP Mining Finance, are attempting to begin to do precisely that, arrange relationships between lithium consumers and lithium producers. If they succeed in that, the access of off-balance sheet mine finance will be greatly facilitated. And lazy securities analysts like myself we'll be able to assign equity valuations to companies because we'll have some certainty as to production volumes and prices, which will really help. It's not present in any other commodity other than uranium.
Right, right. Let's talk nickel here. I met with a couple nickel companies at this conference I was at. When we talked, and that's why I really want to talk to you about nickel. When we talked in the past, and please correct me if I'm saying this wrong, is nickel, the Chinese were driving the price of nickel down, and that was set to end if I'm in sometime in 25.
What? Go ahead. Two things. One of the biggest nickel producers in the world is Russia. And for fairly obvious reasons, the Russians have needed money.
Yes.
The last time they needed money in 1990, they sold platinum, they sold nickel, they sold chromium. Guess what? All of those commodities are in the toilet now. So one can suspect that there's been a substantial amount of Russian dishoarding. In the case of nickel, there has been massive Chinese investment in lateritic nickel production in Indonesia. And the expansion of this lateritic nickel production probably goes on for another year and a half.
Okay.
The decline in nickel product prices has meant that the traditional style of nickel production, which is from sulfide deposits, has been mashed. And then my favorite condition precedent is beginning to be achieved, which is to say the shutdown of nickel capacity around the globe. Small nickel mines and big nickel mines, conventional nickel mines, sulfide nickel mines have been shutting down. In other words, supply is decreasing. At the same time that people who 5 years ago bought into the battery metals hype hate nickel. And as you know, I love hate. We are early on in this because the cycle of Chinese investment into Indonesian nickel, lateritic nickel, continues. What will change, I think, is the amount of environmental damage done by the lateritic nickel production in Sulawesi, an island in Indonesia, is massive. I've seen it. And I don't think that the Indonesian government over time will tolerate it. The people on Sulawesi are beginning not to tolerate it now. And I'm not suggesting that will lead to a cessation of mining on Sulawesi. I'm suggesting that in the fairly near term, the Indonesian government and to a lesser extent the Filipino government will require Chinese mining companies to mine more responsibly, which will raise their cost fairly dramatically.
Definitely.
Right now, as an example, surface waste strip is pushed off the beach. It's merely disposed of in the intertidal area. So it's destroying massive amounts of coral reefs, as an example. The mud plumes that you see off southern Sulawesi have to be seen from the air to be fully comprehended. The second thing that's happening that many people don't know is that in China itself, the standards required of mining companies, particularly around rare earths and coal, is increasing pretty dramatically.
Okay.
And you're going to see, I think, the fact that the costs associated with responsible mining are going to change the cost curves of Chinese producers. And that will inure to the benefit of nickel. Again, we are way early.
Right. All right.
What you want to look for, I think, is either very, very low-cost conventional nickel producers, non-Russian ones, by the way, or if you're outside the U.S., you have the courage, Russian ones. I'm precluded from participating in those opportunities these days. Nickel discoveries that won't be in production for 4 or 5 years, so won't experience the very low prices that we're seeing now, where those discoveries are large enough to matter, and where they would be in the lowest cost quartile worldwide in sulfide nickel production. Hopefully, those discoveries will be in mining-friendly locales. There is a nice discovery, albeit I don't like the grade. I like the size in Western Australia. There is a very nice discovery in Brazil which frees you from some of the political challenges that sulfide nickel producers or lateritic nickel producers will face in other countries.
How about them being nickel being a critical metal now? How about the, I don't know if there's a ban on exporting yet. Do you see that coming?
That could also what I do see coming, and I think it's unfortunate, is I think that the U.S. government will decide it's strategic, and they'll likely waste some of your money and some of mine subsidizing it.
Right.
I mean, I wish they'd dry up and blow away, but I don't think that's what's going to happen. And I guess the economic Rick prefers to be subsidized and taxed. I do think that you will see increasing geopolitical competition for supplies of a whole bunch of materials deemed to be strategic.
Sure.
Given that the increased supply of lateritic nickels, primarily in Indonesia, but also in the Philippines, has been financed by the Chinese, and the Chinese control the offtake, likely what you're going to see is a geopolitical response from the West involving securing supplies of all battery metals, so-called battery metals, including, of course, nickel, but extending to rare earths and probably extending to lithium. I think this is stupid, but I think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Let's talk about copper here, and that we'll finish up with that. Is copper just still a proxy on the overall economy? Is that what you see it is, or are we going headfirst into shortages because of all those mines?
Yeah, in the near term, I think it trades based on economic expectation. And certainly the thing that would halt for a while the copper train would be a global recession or depression. I'm no economist. I'm a credit analyst. So I don't want to burden your listeners with my economic viewpoint. What I would like to point out is that it has been 30 years since we have devoted enough time and enough money to copper exploration to deal with an impending supply shortage. The mines that produce us, our way of living today, Andy, are mines, well, they're like me. They're 70 years old and past their prime, you know? They're old and fat and bald.
Don't be too hard on it once.
You know, you look at the biggest mine in the U.S., Bingham Canyon. Thing's 150 years old.
Right.
The new mines like Grasberg, 65 years old, Escondida, 45 years old. And Andy, your listeners need to understand that you don't come up to the pit wall and throw in fertilizer and water and have it grow more copper. That's not the way it works. So we needed to begin to explore for copper 30 years ago. We didn't do it. So we have a supply shortage no matter what we do. Whether there's a price response will depend on whether we have a recession-induced demand shortage. That's what's going to determine the price, the interplay between supply and demand. But no matter what we do, we're going to have a supply shortage. Some of your listeners, when they think about battery metals and they think about electricity, they think about it from our lens, from a privileged lens, from an American lens. Data centers, electric cars, stuff like that. That isn't half the story. There's 1 billion people on Earth, Andy, who have no access to primary electricity. You generate that electricity with copper. You move it with copper. You use it with copper. There are 2 billion people on Earth that have access to intermittent or unaffordable electricity. And I think that changes over the next 25 years, much as it has over the last 40 years. That requires boatloads, literally boatloads of copper. And we don't have enough copper 5 years from now to meet current demands. Never mind Western demand, data center demand, electric vehicle demand. Past is prologue in this sense. The last commodity boom we had in 2000 was really a consequence of some underinvestment in productive capacity, but more the urbanization of China. And we're seeing the same urbanization, albeit in fits and starts, in India, in Indonesia, in Malawi. The increase in living standards among the poorest of the poor in the world, which is a very good thing, will make a profound difference across the resource space, but particularly in materials associated with the generation of power.
Got it. Let's end on that. And also, actually, let's give a shout out to you. I want to thank you so much for your time. Your last boot camp you were on was about a week or two ago. What do you have coming up here? And give me, again, your contact. People want their portfolios reviewed.
So for the portfolio reviews, that's easy. Ruleinvestmentmedia.com. Go to the website, list your natural resource stocks. Doesn't cost you anything. There's no obligation. It's really easy for me to give people their money's worth when I don't charge them. But that was a no-brainer. You know, I call it an IQ test, and I hope your listeners pass. You know, all value, no charge. The next one, the boot camps, are different. In the boot camps, we take one topic and we go deep. We go 8 hours. I need to say at the top, this is not a place for tourists. If you're doing this for amusement, don't come to the boot camp. Well, we hope to make it amusing. You'll spend 8 hours learning the intricacies of one topic. We've done silver. We've done uranium. We've done royalty and streaming. We've done battery metals. The last one we did was Tier 1 deposits, where we did an in-depth study of those deposits that change the commodities that they're involved in. Deposits that could be worth $50 billion. Both how to invest in them if you're an income investor, because these are multi-decade income streams, but also how to identify emerging Tier 1 deposits in the exploration phase, which is probably the surest way, albeit unsure, to enjoy 10-fold or 20-fold or sometimes 50-fold returns. The information that we presented at the boot camp is timeless. It isn't something where if you missed it, you missed it for good. The knowledge is still good. And if you go to our website, you can buy the recordings of that boot camp. In other words, you can get the knowledge, which is not stale dated at all, for $99. If you buy the boot camp, if you listen to the boot camp and you don't think you got your money's worth, email me. I'll give you a full refund. You'll never get back the 8 hours that you spent listening to the material, but you will get back the money. Absolute ironclad money back guarantee. We have another boot camp coming up in January. I'm 99% sure it's going to be a deep dive into gold, physical gold ownership, ETF ownership, trust certificate ownership, the shares. This will not be a 15-minute dissertation about the fact that the U.S. dollar is going to hell in a handbasket. And that you need to buy bullion so you can afford bread. It won't be anything like that. This will be a very deep, very detailed discussion about not just the why around gold ownership, which we will do in depth, but also the how. Explaining to you the pitfalls, and there are many. So if you really care about the gold space, I would certainly recommend this. Again, it's going to be 8 hours on the day we do it, but we're going to give you so much information in 8 hours that you will not be able to absorb it. We'll give you access to the recordings for a year, and you will need to revisit the recordings several times. I've had to revisit my own recordings in these boot camps, despite the fact that I put on the show. They are very, very, very dense. And one more time, if you're casual, if you're a tourist, don't come.
Two things about that. First thing is I'll put everything in the show notes that I can, all of the links. And the second thing is I'm going to plug your symposium, your conference. We're 9 months away, but for those listening, put it on your calendar. That was awesome. And I did what Rick recommended, which is basically eavesdrop on some of the speakers and the CEOs, follow people around, make connections and have conversations. And I am much wealthier because I did that. So I want to thank you, Rich, for that.
Well, thank you. The conference is a labor of love. I've been doing it, I think, for 28 years. Long enough that I can't remember how long I've been doing it. And like every other educational product that we offer up, it comes with a full money-back guarantee. There's nobody else I know in the conference business that has an unconditional, gold-plated money-back guarantee. But we do. Mm-hmm. Come to Boca Raton in person, or if you can't, come via live stream. Either way, full refund if you're not satisfied. A couple of things that set us apart from other conferences. The first is that every public company exhibitor there is owned by the conference sponsors. Sadly, Andy, there's no guarantee that because I own a stock, it goes up. But there is a guarantee that the process is honest. You know, at most conferences, the qualification to be an exhibitor is a pulse and a check that cashes in reverse order of importance. At our conference, we have to believe in the companies enough that we own them with our own money. Mm-hmm. As you suggest, another feature of the conference is the ability to follow Ross Beaty or Robert Friedland or Randy Smallwood around the exhibition floor and see who they stop in front of, see what questions they ask. I had a guy 6 years ago now email me, and he said, Rick, the ability to follow Robert Friedland around your exhibit floor and eavesdrop on his questions was worth the price of admission. The whole rest of the conference I got for free.
About that point, and I didn't mean to say this, and I told you this in the past, Rick, that's exactly what I did in 1994 at the New Orleans Investment Conference. I followed Rick Rule and Don Casey around the investment conference on the floor and listen to them, what companies they were stopping by and what questions they asked. I did exactly.
That's hilarious. I'm glad I benefited you, albeit at somebody else's conference.
Exactly what you did. Great. Always a pleasure. I'm putting everything in the show notes. I can't thank you so much for your friendship and really your mentorship. It's meant a great deal to me and my family.
My pleasure. I'm glad I've been able to be helpful.
You know, absolutely. Thank you, Rick.